My name is Daisha Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark
secret.
I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock, and I know something about jazz. But when it comes to classical, but I really want to learn. So, every week on this show, a classical music expert will give me a piece of classical music they think I should know, and then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the classical classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and here with me today is Nico Muley. He is a New York-based composer who attended Juilliard. He's written a lot, like a lot of music for the likes of Emmanuel Acts, the Metropolitan Opera, St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, etc., etc. He's also a performer, arranger, and conductor, and he's worked with some of my favorite performers and bands like Bjork, Jonesy, The National, Grizzly Bear. He's the co-founder of the record label Bedroom Community. His most recent work includes the opera Two Boys and the work Object Songs. On April 18th, Nico's latest work, How Little You Are, will have its world premiere right here in Texas at the University of Texas's Bass Concert Hall, which we'll talk about a little more later. Hello, Nico, and welcome to the Classical Classroom.
Thank you for having me.
So what are you going to be teaching me about today?
Well, I think what we should do is talk about how to listen to music that you've never heard before.
Okay.
And music that's brand new into the world.
I like this. So listening to a new piece of music is a much less passive experience than listening to, you know, kind of the golden oldies, you know, your Beethoven,
right,
your Brahms, your Bach, etc. So can you talk about the difference, say, between listening to, like, Object Songs, which you put out this year, and listening to Mozart's The Magic Flute?
Right. Well, I think the thing with golden oldies is there's two ways to think about it. I mean, I think with a very popular piece of older music, let's use Mozart as an example, we all agree culturally more or less that it's good, right?
Yeah.
We're basically on the same page that as a composition, that The Magic Flute is pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So when you go to it, what you're going for is the joy of knowing that you like the piece already, but the thrill and the unknowable quality of the interpretation of the piece.
Uh-huh.
If you take the overture of The Magic Flute as an example, you know, those chords are really iconic, right? If you grab a classical musician and play her the first nanosecond of that chord, there's no other thing it could possibly be, right?
Uh-huh.
Immediately you'll get the answer that it's The Magic Flute Overture.
Uh-huh.
And there are all these decisions, right? How do you balance the chord? Like, what's the relationship of the horns to the strings? How much space between the chords should you put? How fast should it go once the chordal part is done? All these things are decided sort of at that time,
mm-hmm,
by the conductor and to a large extent by the players as well. So you know the listener knows the piece, but the mystery is in how it's going to be retold in this moment here.
Yeah, and that's how classical music is so unique. You know, the sort of classical music pieces that we're accustomed to hearing that have been played forever and ever.
It's, right.
Yeah, that interpretation.
And I think what's kind of interesting is that there are a lot of people. The classical music audience has a really complicated relationship to interpretation because, for instance, there are a lot of people I know who listen to a lot of classical music, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they have very, very, very intense beliefs about what the right way and the wrong way is to do something.
Yeah.
And this stuff gets really crazy around Bach's music in particular.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are people who are really, I always tell this story, but the only time I've ever seen classical musicians fight one another with their hands was about performance practice. It was about a tempo.
No way.
And no, totally. And in a 16th century piece of Flemish music. And it's an amazing thing because you realize that, you know, people really hold these things to be sacred.
Yeah.
And And it's what I was saying before about it happening in a ritualized space. You know, listening to a recording, right, you know, if you like the recording, you know you like it, right? And you know mm-hmm. that you like that interpretation of the piece mm-hmm. and you've bought it for a reason and you can listen to it in your house and you can listen to it while you're doing laundry or not. There's a kind of endless de-ritualizing of it. Whereas if you love yeah. the magic flute, right, if you love it, love it, love it, and you go to the opera and the first chord is like not how you thought it should be, you know, you see people leave.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wow.
And so what's amazing about that is that in the heads of the listeners, and I'm saying this and it sounds like I'm being judgmental, but actually I think it's one of the beauties of what we do as classical musicians. But in your head, I mean, I can use myself as an example. On Thursday night of this week, I'm going to go see the New York Philharmonic play a brand new piece by John Adams, so never heard before, mm-hmm. and Stravinsky's Petrushka, which is a piece that I know very, very well, just as a piece of music on the page, but also, for me, my recording of it with Michael Tilson Thomas, the one with which I grew up, there's never going to be anything better than that, even though that recording has its own weirdnesses. that's my standard for it, right?
Yeah.
So it's gotta be more awesome than that for me to have an okay time. You know what I mean? So it's
right.
and I'm really particular about how loud certain things should be in there, about how the piano should be balanced. You know, I turn into one of those crazy classical music people.
I recently heard a different interpretation of some songs by Verdi. I didn't even realize at first I was listening to the same piece of music. It was so different.
Right.
And I have to say it was a little bit jarring, but then it was cool. I was like, this is interesting.
Yeah, exactly. And I think with song form, there's much more wiggle room than the orchestral tradition.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a great example of that is like when you... I don't know if you bought that Joni Mitchell tribute album that was out a couple of years ago, but you know, Prince singing A Case of You is one of the most extraordinary reinterpretations of the 20th century. Have you heard this thing?
I have not, but I want to.
You need to go and get this right now. It's
okay.
So great. And because what it does is it reminds you of three things. It reminds you of what a great song A Case of You is.
Mm-hmm. I could drink a case of you. And then I would still be on my feet. Oh, I would still be on my feet.
It reminds you of what a powerful, like the original version, right, of Joni Mitchell's version. But it also reminds you of what an amazing musician Prince is.
Yeah.
Right, so you get three things at once, right? You're like, I love the piece, I love the original interpretation, and I love this new interpretation,
mm-hmm.
and that is, you know, in a sense, kind of when you're listening to classical music and when you're listening to the golden oldies, that's the mental kind of triangulation that's going on.
This is kind of a weird question.
Tell me.
But like in pop music and rock music, tropes that kind of reoccur in the music have changed over time. I mean, I'm sure that's true in classical music too. What kind of tropes are going on? And like, what should people listen for when you're listening to contemporary classical music?
That is the big question, isn't it? There are a lot of ways to answer that question. If you're listening to a brand by brand new piece, right, and you have no idea what to expect, I always feel like you can pay attention to color. It's a great pathway into even the thorniest contemporary music.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how are the instruments being used in combination with each other, or in you know, how are they being differentiated from each other?
Mm-hmm.
How is sort of, I would say, sort of light and dark sort of interplay. But
yeah.
it's really hard to describe because I think the tropes such as they are all over the place. And in contemporary music, it's not like there's a handbook of stuff. There are a lot of composers whose music, basically the currency of their music is using the instruments in unusual ways. Mm-hmm. So if you're at that kind of concert, the thing to listen to is how many different ways do you see the person playing the viola, right? So here she's bowing it in the correct place. Here she's bowing it in a weird place. Here she's plucking it. Here she's plucking it with a guitar pick. You know, that's one kind of economy of listening. In my music specifically, I always feel like the thing you can listen for, one itinerary through a piece, mm-hmm. would be to listen for how repetition functions. So is it obsessive repetition? Is it ritualistic repetition? Mm-hmm. Is it broken repetition? Like, as in, does it change each time? Is it sort of repetition that accumulates material, like spins something out of a repeated gesture? Or is it the opposite?
Oh,
is it repetition
that undoes
something? That's one thing to listen for. I mean, it's, you know, I wouldn't presume to tell people how to listen to my music, but that's sometimes what I listen for.
Well, that is a trope, I guess, or whatever you want to call it, that's changed in classical music over time. Like when you listen to, I don't know, like Koyaanisqatsi or something like that, as opposed to the repetition that you hear in, I can't even draw up another piece of contemporary classical music that's more current, except for yours. Actually, I was just listening to Object Songs, and it does have a few moments of that repetition, but it's very different.
Yeah, or it's patterns that, yeah, I mean, I think, I right, exactly, like if you go to a Philip Glass piece, I think the thing to ask yourself with his music is always, where is the motor behind this, right?
Uh-huh.
Like what's driving the truck? And I think that's one of the things that's kind of like a hallmark of his music, is that there are these harmonic motors and rhythmic motors, and you can kind of, if you identify those, then you're really kind of participating in the ride.
So you're about to premiere this new work, and that got me thinking about, like, what does that mean today? Most classical music that we hear today premiered, you know, way before any of us were born.
Right. Well, I think, yeah. You know, what's super thrilling about a brand new piece, right, is that for a minute, and while, you know, while it's being put together and while it's being rehearsed, the only people who've heard it are the people in the room who are making it. So in the case of this piece, it'll be, you know, a choir of however many people, maybe 30 people, and then 12 guitarists and a conductor. So that's, you know, under 50 people know this music.
Wow.
And then suddenly when you premiere it, that number increases by a lot, or you hope by a lot.
Yeah.
And so suddenly there's a couple hundred people or 1,000 people who have heard this thing for the first time and begin to develop a relationship with it, you know, which can be a small relationship, or it can start you down a rabbit hole of, mm-hmm. you know, investigating more of the composer's works, or being, you know, completely repelled by it, or it's a kind of magic event.
But like specifically, so you've written a new work, and you're like, I want to put this baby out into the world now. Do you go up to someone important and say, I would like to premiere my work now, please?
No, it's the exact opposite, actually.
Okay.
Generally, what happens is that a group, like an organization, so that can be either an orchestra or a choir, or in some cases it's a building, says, we'd like to commission you to write a piece of music. We'd like to cause you to create a premiere.
Gotcha.
And so what they give you is a set of parameters, and that the parameters are usually, you know, how long the thing should be, when it's due, and how much money they're going to pay you. And then in exchange for that, you hand them a piece of paper, basically, that has all the notes on it. So it, in a sense, it's not that feeling of, I have this thing bursting to get out of my chest and I need to find the right house for it. So, yeah, the commissioning system is kind of sets up the parameters for you. So you don't have to sort of peddle your wares.
Oh, that's kind of nice. So, but like when I hear a new piece of music by, say, a band that I like, it's very exciting. Like when Arcade Fire, for example, puts out a new album, I'm like somewhere between super excited and kind of in crash position because part of me is kind of afraid of how it will sound. What's that experience like from your side?
It's pretty palpable. I mean, I attend the first performances of most everything I write. And it's really scary because what you're doing as a composer is you're begging the attention of the audience for a certain amount of time. And you're making the argument that, you know, the 8-minute long piece that I just wrote is worth 8 minutes of your silence, basically, eight minutes of your attention, you as the audience member. And it's really scary because sometimes you feel like you're trying people's patience. And sometimes you feel like there are people who are there expecting one thing and get another. And I think it's interesting that you talked about bands, because in a lot of cases, bands who are really, really good at a thing, right? The thing that people like about them is sometimes not replicatable in another album. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's so personal. And, you know, a lot of times it has to do with not even the music that the band is making, but the emotional state of the listener when, like, for instance, I mean, for me, like, if we're going to talk about the Arcade Fire, I remember exactly where I was when I first heard Funeral, and it was a pretty, like, joyful time in my life, and it was, like, just the right time of year, and it was all kind of happening, and, like, a friend of mine had just moved into New York from out of town, and it was, like, those circumstances are not repeatable.
Yeah, yeah. You as the listener, it kind of coincided with these circumstances that were going on with you, and it created this, like, magic around the listening experience.
Right. Now, the advantage of classical music, or of concert music, I should say, is that you are exposed to a work, particularly the world premiere of a work, in a sort of ritualized environment.
Yeah. That's so strange to me.
It is strange, but it's slightly more controllable. Uh-huh. So if you release your album out into the world, for instance, right, some people are listening to it on crappy speakers from their phone. Some people are listening to it in the car. Mm-hmm. Some people are listening to it in the background of what they're doing. Some people are listening to it in the foreground of what they're doing. Whereas the concert experience is slightly more manageable in a sense. Because you say, I mean, there are obviously differences of the user experience. But in general, you know, we've all turned up at 8 o'clock. We've all agreed to obey a sort of sense of decency and quiet during this time. Mm-hmm. You know, the message is much more controllable.
Well, how are the audiences different? I mean, you've worked with like popular rock, indie, all that kind of stuff, and you've worked in this classical world, which is obviously very different.
You know, honestly, I wonder this all the time, and it's not something to which I have a ready answer. It's kind of baffling, actually, like when you have a concert or a piece of yours is on a concert, whatever, and I always kind of want to set up a little booth in the lobby and ask who all these people are. Because that's the biggest change in your life, right, is when, you know, normally when you write music and when you're in school, obviously the people who hear it are your friends, right? And at a certain point, more people, there are more people listening to it than people you know, and that's a weird moment, right? Like, how did you come to buy tickets to this thing, right? You know, one of the things I did at the Met when I had this big crazy opera last season, or two seasons ago, the place from which I would watch, you could sort of see the people who were coming in, but they couldn't see you. And it was totally baffling. Like, there were a lot of people I recognized from, you know, I recognized the demographic where it was like, these are people who go to every opera, right? So that's why they're here. And then there were people, I was like, those look like academics, you know? And then I was like, those are like gay music fans. and well, you know, you start seeing these sort of tribes of people moving around and you're like, those are like dapper art curator people. Uh-huh. And it's always fascinating. And it's, you know, one of the great kind of joys and also anxieties of my life as a composer is that I don't really have to worry about it. Like, it's not my job to fuss with who the audience is. And because it's so unpredictable, you can't write at an audience. You can't say, like, this is who I'm aiming this at. Like, I mean, honestly, it's like I could not tell you who in Texas is going to come to this thing.
It's going to be interesting.
One presumes that people will, but, you know, I just can't imagine who it's going to be. But you know, that having been said, you don't want to imagine it, because if I knew, it wouldn't be fun. And that's the kind of thrill.
Okay, so it is thrilling for you. I was wondering if, like, you know, as a composer of a work at one of these things, like, are you looking around at people's faces going, do they like it? What are they
about it? I'm totally doing that. I'm totally doing it. You know, an audience really changes the kind of atmosphere, obviously, of a room. But I don't know if you've ever had this experience where you've gone to a concert and you can pinpoint the moment when everyone is either rapt or when they lose focus,
yes.
Right? It's sort of like a group of people clapping together. Like there arrives a synchronicity. And my psychological sort of default is I always imagine that the whole time is the moment when everyone's lost.
Mm-hmm.
So I sit there in sort of anguish. I try, you know, honestly, if I can do it, I'll try to watch things from side stage or from somewhere where I'm not, like, my contorted body is not visible to concert goers. Someone made an archival video of a project I did a couple years ago where I was made to sit in the audience because it was, like, part of the thing. And, you know, when you watch the video of the piece, you can literally see me writhing. The whole time it's just like, you know, I'm like twisting my body into knots and twitching.
that would so be me. I would either hide or not attend. I don't think I could stand that kind of pressure.
But that's scary.
Well, one more question before you go. I know you're a busy guy. I know that we obviously cannot hear the music for your world premiere just yet, but can you talk a bit about, I don't know, what to expect, your inspiration, that kind of thing?
Absolutely. Well, you know, here's the thing. In this particular case, the commission was offered to me, and it was offered with the stipulation that I write for a given ensemble, and the given ensemble was 12 acoustic guitars and choir. Now, 12 acoustic guitars, the less scary way to say that is 3 guitar quartets, even though it's the same. And so once you have that as a given, and once you have choir as a given, the next trick is how to find a text that requires 12 guitars, right? So it's not just 12 guitars for fun. It has to require 12 guitars. And what is the drama of the text? And I knew it was going to be a sort of longer work. So it's between 30 and 35 minutes maybe. Mm-hmm. And so I poked around the archive at UT Austin, and I was looking for diaries or documents that related to the expansion westward, particularly in Texas and the other sort of prairies. And so I found a bunch of texts, almost all written by women who were living in most situations either alone or with it was unclear where their husbands were, because their husbands were sort of out, like, going farther west, and they had left women in a sort of homesteading situation.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating about these diaries is that it's the sort of anti-sentimentality of the Laura Ingalls Wilder books, because nothing good ever happens, right?
No.
It's like the husband leaves, the kids die, another kid dies. And then our hero stops diarizing because she dies. So, but I think the romance of the expansion is what we learn about. But the hardship is really crazy, and the fact that there isn't a kind of end to the story always.
Yeah.
Right? I latched on to one of these texts by Mary Alma Blankenship, and she's talking about, you know, the wide open landscape, and she says, you know, we felt the absence of home folk, but when you get among such grandeur, you get to feel how little you are, how foolish is human endeavor, except that which unites us with the almighty force called God. And so here you have this moment of a woman who, other places in her writing, is obsessed with, you know, planting, and is obsessed with cooking, and is obsessed with how to make this land arable. Mm-hmm. And then she looks up for a second, right? And that's, I think, when you get the necessity of those 12 guitars to describe the kind of homophonic grandeur of that landscape.
Yeah.
That was my starting point. And then I was thinking about, there's a beautiful text by Eleanor Pruitt Stewart, who is describing trying to fall asleep in her cabin, and miles and miles and miles away on a still night, there's a cowboy singing kind of sort of lonesome songs. Yeah. And that image really stuck with me as a kind of piece of musical history and as a piece of social history. So the whole piece ends, How Little You Are, ends with a bunch of cowboy songs being sung by each member of the choir in a different tempo. Mm-hmm. So you get this sense of a kind of surround thing. it's hard to describe, but I wanted to feel the implication of loneliness, but a kind of a musical togetherness that this woman has with a man whom she'll never meet, right, who's 50 miles away.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear it. This sounds awesome.
It's a downer, but it'll be good.
Well, and once again, that will be a world premiere of Nico Muhly's work, How Little You Are. It's going to be April 18th, and awesome. We'll put links on our website.
I will see you all there.
Oh, yeah. Nico Muhly, thank you so much for being on the Classical
Classroom. The pleasure
was mine. It was awesome to talk to you. All right, everybody, that does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more Classroom, go to HoustonPublicMedia.org/classroom, or you can find us on SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, basically everywhere. You can follow us on Twitter. You can also Tumble us. You can send me an email at dclay@HoustonPublicMedia.org. Thanks today to audio producer Todd TIE Fighter Hulslander for making us sound good. Thanks to program director Sinjin Flynn for just being him. Thanks to editor Mark DeClaudio for his piercing albino eyes. Thanks to me for saying words. But most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.